For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay. Well, this is kind of the subject that comes up in this book. Who's the real king? Esther 1, chapter 1. These things happened in the days of King Xerxes, who reigned over 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia. Yeah, a well-known guy. This is the so-called Persian Empire. And we can turn to tons of material about him. At that time, Xerxes ruled his empire from his royal throne in the fortress of Susa. Xerxes is the guy that invaded Greece. The 300 Spartans, you know, with the giant army, that was him. He failed in that particular encounter. But he definitely the most powerful man on earth at this time in history, at this point in history, without any doubt. His life, 519 to 465, he's the fourth king in this Achaemenid Empire, the Persians. His rule went from 486 to 465, this event during that period. In the Bible, it's Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. But actually, Esther should be in between Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra is a dude, by the way. And there's a good chance that he's the author of this book. In fact, him or Nehemiah are probably the two most likely guys to be the author of this book, to tell the story. Ahasuerus, some people believe, refers to Xerxes. Some think it refers to Artaxerxes after him. We'll just take what the text says here. Okay, so we're at a period here in history where most of the Jews are not living in Israel. They're living over in this Persian Empire. They were conquered by Babylon, exiled from their country. Then the Babylonians were conquered by the Persians. Most of the Jews are still there. Some of them have gone back already to get the temple started. But most Jews are still living in Persia. Probably about 40 to 60,000 Jews total in this area. The Jewish people had diminished to a very small a fraction of what they used to be. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials, and he invited all the military officers of Persia and Media, as well as the princes and nobles of the provinces. The celebration lasted 180 days. A tremendous display of the opulent wealth of his empire and the pomp and splendor of his majesty. You know, we hear these accounts of a 180-day party, and it sounds like that's pretty far-fetched, but we sure hear a lot of them from different sources. Basically, you know, you've made so many million talents of gold and silver, what do? You party. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where you either would drink and party and feast all night and then sleep it off and get up and start doing it again the next day. Yeah, they did it. This was a payback, really, for his commanders and his nobles for winning the empire. So when it was all over, then he gave another banquet for all the people. So this is not just the upper crust. But now everyone gets to party, from the greatest to the least, who are in the fortress of Susa. It lasted for 7 days and was held in the courtyard of the palace garden. The courtyard was beautifully decorated with white cotton curtains and blue hangings, which were fastened with white linen cords, purple ribbons, to silver rings embedded in marble pillars. Gold and silver couches stood in the mosaic pavement, periphery, marble, mother of pearl, other costly stones. Sounds like this writer was there, doesn't it? In that kind of detail, this isn't a fiction, you know, an ancient fiction, right? This is somebody saying, I can't believe what I saw in there. Drinks were served in gold goblets and many designs, and there was an abundance of royal wine, reflecting the king's generosity. By edict of the king, no limits were placed on the drinking, for the king had instructed all of his palace officials to serve each man as much as he wanted. It's like one of those weddings you go to, and if you look away from your glass, you turn back and it's full of champagne again. Somebody, they've got these guys just going around and nailing you. Dangerous. At the same time, Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women of the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day of the feast, when the king Xerxes was in high spirits because of the wine, i.e. drunk, okay, he told the seven eunuchs who attended him, those guys, to bring Queen Vashti to him with a royal crown on her head. The Talmud, written much later, a Jewish document, claims that he wanted her to come over with the crown on her head only, that he was going to parade her around naked. Most historians think that's pretty unlikely. They didn't have that. But even dressed, being paraded around in front of a bunch of leering, gawking, drunken dudes, not many women's idea of a good night, especially when you're having your own party with the ladies. Anyway, he wanted men to gaze on her beauty, for she was a very beautiful woman. But when they conveyed the king's order to Queen Vashti, she refused to come. This made the king furious, and he burned with anger. This was back before women did that kind of thing. He immediately consulted with his wise advisors, who knew all the Persian laws and customs, for he always asked their advice. And these are their names. Seven nobles of Persia and Media. They met with the king regularly and held the highest positions in the empire. What must be done to Queen Vashti? The king demanded. What penalties does the law provide for a queen who refuses to obey the king's orders, properly sent through his eunuchs? Memucan answered the king and his nobles, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also every noble and citizen throughout your empire. Women everywhere will begin to despise their husbands when they learn that Queen Vashti has refused to appear before the king. Before this day is out, wives of all the king's nobles throughout Persia and me are going to hear that the queen did, and they'll start to treat their husbands the same way. There'll be no end to their contempt and anger. Typical weak male here, afraid we got to keep the women down. We're going to have a big mess on our hands. So, if it pleased the king, we suggest that you issue a written decree, a law of the Persians and Medes that cannot be revoked. And it should order that Queen Vashti be forever banished from the presence of King Xerxes, and that the king should choose another queen more worthy than she. When this decree is published throughout the king's vast empire, then the husbands everywhere, whatever their rank, will receive the proper respect from their wives. The king and his nobles thought that made sense. Sounded pretty good. So he followed Memucan's counsel. He sent letters to all parts of the empire, each province in its own script and language, proclaiming that every man should be the ruler of his own home and should say whatever he pleases. Good old-fashioned patriarchy. Chapter 2. But after Xerxes' anger had subsided, he began thinking about Vashti and what he had done and the decree he'd made. Maybe he's getting a little lonely. We know actually he had many wives. We know the guy after him, Artaxerxes, had over 300 wives. So this is... he's not that lonely. But his personal attendants suggested, let's search the empire to find beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint agents in each of the provinces to bring these beautiful young women into the royal harem at the fortress of Susa. Haggai, the king's eunuch in charge of the harem, will see that they're all given beauty treatments. After that, the young women who most pleased the king will be made queen instead of Vashti. Well, Xerxes thought about that, and he thought that sounded like a pretty good idea. So he had put the plan into effect. At that time, there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, and he was a descendant of Kish and Shimei. His family had been among those who, with King Jehoiakim of Judah, had been exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. That's the Babylonians earlier. This man had a very beautiful and lovely young cousin, Hadassah, who was also called Esther. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her into his family and raised her as his own daughter. As a result of the king's decree, Esther, along with many other young women, was brought to the king's harem at the fortress of Susa and placed in Haggai's care. So this was not something you volunteer for or apply for. It's like, let's get that one right there. And, you know, you really have no say about this whatsoever. It's just you've been chosen. Now, they were getting married to him. So it was technically, you know, I mean, it was a polygamy. But, you know, it wasn't technically against Jewish law for her to marry this guy. Anyway, Haggai was very impressed with Esther and he treated her kindly. He quickly ordered a special menu for her, provided her with beauty treatments. He also assigned her 7 maids, especially chosen from the king's palace, and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not told anyone of her nationality and family background because Mordecai had directed her not to do so. So nobody knows she's a Jew. They just think she's pretty. Every day, Mordecai would take a walk near the courtyard of the harem to find out about Esther and what was happening to her. She had chambermaids who could probably go out to the fence and, you know, you couldn't, obviously, you could not go into the harem, anyone. But there were eunuchs and chambermaids that could come to the fence and talk through it about what's going on. It sounds like that's what was going on. Before each young woman was taken to the king's bed, she was given the prescribed 12 months of beauty treatments. 6 months with oil, myrrh, followed by 6 months with special perfumes and ointments. Probably just given rub downs and I don't know what all. When it was time for her to go to the king's palace, she was given her choice of whatever clothing or jewelry she wanted to take from the harem. So there's just this vast wardrobe to pick from. And that evening, she was taken to the king's private rooms. And the next morning, she was brought to the second harem. So you kind of pass through. These are the used ones over here. The virgins over there. And where the king's wives live. So she's technically his wife now. There, she would be under the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch in charge of concubines. She would never go to the king again unless he had especially enjoyed her and requested her by name. Well, Esther was taken to King Xerxes at the royal palace in the early winter of the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than any of the other young women. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her to be queen instead of Vashti. She won the contest. To celebrate the occasion, he gave a great banquet in Esther's honor for all of his nobles and officials, declaring a public holiday for the provinces and giving tremendous gifts to everyone. Even after all the young men and women had been transferred to the second harem and Mordecai had become a palace official, Esther continued to keep her family background and nationality a secret. She was still following Mordecai's directions just as she did when she lived in his home. So they still don't know she's Jewish. Well, time for a random, unrelated story. So Esther became queen. Meanwhile, Mordecai, her cousin, was on duty at the king's gate. The gate is actually, the gatehouse is actually a large room so that when you attack the city, you cannot just go straight at the gates. You had to come into this gatehouse and then turn and attack. So it made it a lot harder to attack the weakest point in the wall, which was the gates. In there were benches and stuff, and it was kind of a big, it was a center of a government. And so you'll hear about the men sitting in the gates, Yeah, because it's a room. It's big. It's probably half the size of this area here. And that's where they held court. That's where people had deals, kind of certified, witnessed, with documents and stuff like that. This is what he's an official. He's working for the king in the gates. While he's out there, he hears two of the king's eunuchs Bigthana and Teresh, who were guards at the door of the king's private quarters, so they're very close to the king, became angry at King Xerxes and plotted to assassinate him. But Mordecai heard about the plot and he gave the information to Queen Esther. And she told the king about it and gave Mordecai credit for the report. Well, an investigation was made and Mordecai's story was found to be true. The two men were impaled on a sharpened pole, a standard Persian method of execution. This impaling business was pretty bad. They actually would get you up there and get you started on the sharpened pole, and your writhing in pain would kind of work the shaft up through the body and often out the mouth. So by then you were usually dead. But it took a while. It was super, pretty mean people here. This was all recorded in the book of the history of the kings of Xerxes' reign. End of the random story. Well, sometime later, King Xerxes promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, over all the other nobles and making him the most powerful official in the empire. All the king's officials would bow before Haman to show him respect whenever he passed by, so the king had commanded. But Mordecai refused to bow down or to show him respect. So he comes walking past, and everywhere he goes, everybody bows. And here's this one guy just standing there. Well, Jews did not believe in bowing down, particularly to other gods. And this is often linked, can be linked, to the fact that a lot of these nobles and kings consider themselves to have a divine aspect. Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, there's a number of cases we have where under Jewish law, you cannot go bowing down to someone that thinks or claims he's a god. And they may also have, they may be wearing idol gizmos as decorations, and that bowing that, some Jews would feel that that was out of bounds as well. So he wouldn't bow down. Then the palace officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, they said, why are you disobeying the king's command? They spoke to him a few days after that, but he still refused to comply with the order. So they spoke to Haman about this to see if he would tolerate Mordecai's conduct, since Mordecai had told them he was a Jew. It's like, we're Jews, we don't do that. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down or show him respect, he was filled with rage. He had learned of Mordecai's nationality, so he decided it was not enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Xerxes. And so, yeah, so often the case. Not enough to get the guy that's pissing you off. You've got to kill the Jews. So in the month of April, during the 12th year of King Xerxes' reign, lots were cast in Haman's presence. The lot is called a pur, and the plural is purim. So this is the name, if you're familiar with Judaism, they still celebrate Purim today as a festival reminding them of this story where the Jews got saved from destruction. Again, giving it away. To determine the best day and month to take action. And the day selected was March 7th, nearly a year later. Then Haman approached King Xerxes. He says, there's a certain race of people scattered all through the province of your empire who keep themselves separate from everyone else. Their laws are different from those of other people, and they refuse to obey the laws of the king. So it's not in the king's interest to let them live. If it pleases the king, issue a decree that they be destroyed, and I will give 10,000 large sacks of silver into the government administrator so they'll be deposited in the royal treasury. 10,000 sacks of silver to get rid of this entire race. Well, Xerxes kind of liked that idea. He said, yeah, okay. Removed the signet ring from his finger, and he gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said, the money and the people are both yours. Do with it as you see fit. And so, blank check. On April 17th, the king's secretaries were summoned, and a decree was written exactly as Haman dictated. It was sent to all the king's highest officers, the governors, the respective provinces, and nobles of each province in their own scripts and their own languages. The decree was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. So it becomes irrevocable at that point. Dispatches were sent by swift messengers into all provinces of the empire, giving the order that all the Jews, young and old, including women and children, must be killed, slaughtered, and annihilated in a single day. This was scheduled to happen on March 7th of next year. The property of the Jews could be given to those who killed them. So it's basically anyone who wants a piece of the action, go kill a Jew, and you can take whatever he owns. That'll be yours now. So there's a little incentive here. A copy of this decree was to be issued as law in every province and proclaimed to all the people so that they would be ready to do their duty on the appointed day. At the king's command, the decree went out by swift messengers, and it was also proclaimed in the fortress of Susa. And then the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa fell into confusion. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all about that had done, he tore his clothes and put on burlap and ashes, typical Near Eastern ancient form of mourning. Throw ash in the air and all your hair, wearing burlap instead of clothing. I think of Job did the same thing. Cried out with a loud and bitter wail. He went as far as the gate of the palace, for no one was allowed to enter the palace gate while wearing clothes of mourning. And as news of the king's decree reached all the provinces, there was great mourning among all the Jews. They fasted, wept, wailed, and many people lay in burlap and ashes. When Queen Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was deeply distressed. She sent him clothing to replace the burlap, but he refused it. Then she sent Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed as her attendant. She ordered him to go to Mordecai and find out what was troubling him and why he was mourning. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the square in front of the palace gate. And Mordecai told him the whole story, including the exact sum of amount of money Haman had promised to pay to the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. And he even gave Hathach a copy of the decree issued in Susa that called for the death of all the Jews. And he asked Hathach to show it to Esther and explain the situation to her. He also asked Hathach to direct her to go to the king to beg for mercy and plead for the people. Well, so he goes back, Hathach goes back to Esther with Mordecai's message. But Esther sends another message back through Hathach to Mordecai. All the king's officials and even the people of the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his gold scepter. And the king has not called for me to come to him for over 30 days. If I go walking in there, chances are excellent I'm going to get killed. Well, Hathach gave that message to Mordecai. And Mordecai sent this reply back to Esther. Don't think for a moment, just because you're in the palace, that you'll escape when all the other Jews are killed. Somebody's going to find out that you're a Jew, and you'll get it too. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place. But you and your relatives will die. Who knows? Perhaps you were made the queen for just such a time as this. Who indeed? People object to the book of Esther. Some of the ancient rabbis and even early Christians complained about this book because it never mentions the name of God in the book. But it's unnecessary to mention the name of God. You can obviously see what's implied here. Perhaps you were made queen. Made by who? Mordecai's view is that, you know, God is really the one running the thing here. If deliverance for the Jews doesn't come from you, God will bring it some other way. And yet here, you know, this is just too coincidental that you just happen to be queen. We have a Jewish woman sitting on the throne at a time when this kingdom's trying to kill all Jews in sight. That's not a coincidence. And so he, of course, can't be sure. He's guessing. God is not guessing. God has seen all of this coming. And you kind of have to, you know, you have to take read the story in the flavor in which it's written, which shows that this is basically all being orchestrated. The whole thing is being orchestrated by God. That's what this story is about. When Esther sent this reply, then she sent this reply back to Mordecai. Okay, go gather together all the Jews of Susa and fast for me. Here again, why would they be fasting? Fasting and praying is what, that's why you fast. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. My maids and I will do the same. And then, though it is against the law, I will go in to see the king. And if I must die, I must die. So Mordecai went away and did everything Esther had ordered him. On the third day of the feast, Esther put on her royal robes, or the fast, rather. Esther put on her royal robes, and she entered the court of the palace just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. So Esther approached and touched the end of the scepter. I'm not even going to say anything about that. Some people think there's kind of a phallic thing with the scepter going on there, but I'm not saying that. You didn't hear that from me. I heard it. Then the king asked her, "So what do you want?" Queen Esther, what's your request? I'll give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. Esther replied, "Well, if it pleased the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet that I've prepared for the king. Let's feast." Well, king turns to his assistants and tell Haman to come quickly to the banquet as Esther has requested. So the king and Haman went to Esther's banquet. While they're drinking wine, the king said to Esther, "Okay, now tell me what you really want. What's your request? I'll give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom." Esther replied, "This is my request and my deepest wish. If I find favor with the king, if it pleases the king to grant my request and do as I ask, please come with Haman tomorrow and we'll have another banquet." Then I'll explain what this is all about. I don't know whether she's chickened out, whether she just didn't feel right about the time, whether she felt that a double dip would be good here, double feast. Let's do this again. She's maybe baiting him along, a little hard to get on this request. Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet. But when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, Haman became furious. However, he restrained himself and went on home. Haman gathered together his friends and Zereth, his wife. And he boasted to them about his great wealth and his many children. He bragged about the honors the king had given him and how he had been promoted over all the other nobles and officials. And Haman added, "And that's not all. Queen Esther invited only me and the king himself to the banquet she prepared for us. And she's invited me to come again tomorrow." You can just see him kind of strutting up and down the room about all the great things about me. But then he says, "All of this is worth nothing as long as I see that Mordecai Jew sitting there at the palace gate." The bitterness poisoning all of his privilege. I could get that guy. So Haman's wife, Zeresh, and all his friends suggested, "Hey, why don't you set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall? We'll plug him right on there and watch him do his thing." and we can impale Mordecai on it. And when this is done, then you can go on your merry way with the king. Oh, this pleased Haman, and he ordered that the pole get set up in his backyard. So all the neighbors and everyone are going to watch Mordecai eat it. That night, the king had trouble sleeping, chapter 6. So he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so he could read it to him. In those records, he discovered an account of how Mordecai had exposed the plot of Bigthana and Teresh. Two of the eunuchs who guarded the door to the king's private quarters, they had plotted to assassinate King Xerxes. That's very coincidental, isn't it? This is the night before Mordecai is going to go on the stake. The old king just can't sleep. Something's keeping him awake. Calls for some reading. And lo and behold, this passage falls open. That worked out mighty nice. And of course, that's the way this whole book is. There are no coincidences here at all. None of this is coincidence. He says to his dudes, to the readers, "What reward or recognition did we ever give Mordecai for this?" the king asked. His attendants replied, "Nothing's been done for him." He still doesn't know that Mordecai and Esther have anything to do with each other. That still hasn't been revealed. "Well, who is that out in the outer court out there?" the king said. As it happened, Haman had just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai on a pole he had prepared. So the attendants replied to the king, "That's Haman out there." And the king said, "Bring him in." He comes walking into the room. And he says, "Hey, Haman, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me?" Well, Haman thought to himself, "Who would the king wish to honor more than me?" It's like, I'm basically getting to name my own reward here. So he's like, "Well, let's see. Okay, I got it. If the king wishes to honor someone, he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes, as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden, one with a royal emblem on its head. And then let the robes and the horse be handed over to the king's most noble officials, and let them see the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's robes and led through the city square on the king's horse, and have the officials shout out as they go, 'This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor.'" You can really tell this Haman is just really hung up on people bowing and just public glorification. He loves that. Xerxes is like, "Yeah, awesome. Quick, take the robes of my horse and do just as you have said. For Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the gate by the palace." Can you imagine Haman at this point? It's just like, "No way." "Yeah," he says, "do all of it. Leave nothing out that you suggested." So the high official that gets to lead the horse through is Haman himself. Gets to lead me. I've been asked before by people, does God have a sense of humor? Come on. Read Esther. There's quite a few passages, actually, that talks about God laughing. So our enjoyment of laughter and humor is part of the image of God, the ability to see irony and to see things that are just funny. You also see this reversal theology. You know how Jesus taught that the greatest will be least and the least will be greatest, and that which is admired and respected by man is despicable in the eyes of God and stuff like that. Just the complete overturning of values. And one of the things that God really, in particular, deplores in fallen humans is pride. It really turns them off. Major. God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And this Haman dude is a pride freak. I mean, he's just completely out of control on this. And so guess what? He's going to get humiliated in this way. So Haman took the robes. I mean, you don't mess with Xerxes. You put him on Mordecai, placed him on the king's own horse, and led him through the city square shouting, "This is what the king does to them he wants to honor." Afterward, Mordecai returned to the palace gate, but Haman hurried home, dejected and completely humiliated. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and his friends what had happened, his wise advisors and his wife said, "Since Mordecai, this man who is humiliating you, is of Jewish birth, you'll never succeed in your plans against him. It will be fatal to continue opposing him." So he gets the warning. He could probably still get out of this, you know, if he came forward and said, "I've been in the wrong, and, you know, forgive me," and there's a good chance he could still get out of this, but if he keeps going, he's not going to stop. While they're still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and quickly took Haman to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Banquet number deuce. Chapter 7, so the king and Haman went to the queen Esther's banquet. On this second occasion, while they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, "Tell me, what is it you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I'll give it to you even if it's half the kingdom." And Queen Esther replied, "If I have found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of my people be spared. For my people have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. If we had just been sold to slaves, I would have remained quiet. That would have been too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. Who would do such a thing?" the Xerxes demanded. "Who would be so presumptuous to touch you?" And she looks over. "This wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy." Haman grew pale with fright before the king and the queen. The king jumped to his feet in a rage and stormed out of the palace into the garden. Not looking good for Haman right here. Haman, however, stayed behind to plead for his life with Queen Esther, for he knew that the king intended to kill him. And in despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining. Remember, they don't sit at chairs at a table when they're feasting. They have couches and they recline at table. And then you just kind of pick things off a low table there. So he's down, you know, next to her couch, you know, pleading, "Let me die." And this doesn't look too good when King Xerxes comes walking in and sees this guy bent down over his wife. He shouts out, "My God, will he even assault the queen right here in the palace before my very eyes?" And as soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face, signaling his doom. Then Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, "You know..." Word on the street is that Haman set up a sharpened pole to stand 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. And they say he's going to use it to impale Mordecai, the man who saved you from assassination. Oh. This is, well. Things going downhill fast for Haman here. The solution's obvious. Good, impale Haman on it, the king ordered. No problem. And so they took him out and impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Chapter 8. On that same day, King Xerxes gave the property of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And when Mordecai was brought before the king, for Esther now told the king how they were related, the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken back from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai this time. And Esther appointed Mordecai to be in charge of Haman's property. Then Esther went again before the king, falling down at his feet and begging him with tears to stop the evil plot devised by Haman the Agagite against the Jews. It's still going forward. Because all of those signed, sealed decrees are still out there. Again, the king held out the gold scepter to Esther, so she rose and stood before him. She said, if it please the king, and if I found favor with him, and if he thinks it's right if I'm pleasing to him, then let there be a decree that reverses the orders of Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, who ordered that the Jews through all the king's provinces should be destroyed. For how can I endure to see my people and my family slaughtered and destroyed? The king Xerxes said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, I've given Esther the property of Haman. He's been impaled on a pole because he tried to destroy the Jews. Now, go ahead and send a message to the Jews in the king's name, telling them whatever you want. Seal it with the king's signet ring. But remember that whatever has already been written in the king's name and sealed with the signet ring can never be revoked. So whatever you write, you can't revoke what already was signed into law. By the way, this is historically known to be exactly the way it was in the Persian Empire, and it shows close knowledge of Persian customs. Even the king himself could not see the story of Daniel in the lion's den, which was also in the Persian Empire. He could not reverse his edict that whoever did this would be thrown into the lion's den, even though he liked Daniel as one of his favorite guys. He had him thrown in. Anyway. And so on June 25th, the king's secretaries were summoned and a decree was written exactly as Mordecai dictated. It was sent to the Jews and the highest officers, governors, and nobles of all 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia. The decree was written in the scripts and languages of all the people of the empire, including that of the Jews. The decree was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. Mordecai sent the dispatches by swift messengers who rode fast horses specially bred for the king's service. The king's decree gave the Jews in every city authority to unite and defend them, their lives. They were allowed to kill, slaughter, and annihilate anyone of any nationality or province who might attack them or their children or wives, and to take the property of their enemies. So basically, he warns them that it's coming and gives them the right to defend themselves. And of course, anyone reading a decree like this, sealed by the king, you don't have to be too good at reading between the lines to get the feeling like, I don't think Xerxes wants us to attack the Jews, after all. You can kind of pick that up here. And so in the event, it turned out there was really no violence at all. The day chosen for this event throughout all the provinces, March 7th, which is the one that had been picked earlier. Then Mordecai left the king's presence wearing the royal robe of blue and white, the great crown of gold, and an outer cloak of fine linen and purple, and the people of Susa celebrated the new decree. The Jews were filled with joy and gladness and were honored everywhere. Instead of being killed, the other peoples realized somehow the Jews have become buddies with Xerxes, so they treated him with honor. In every province and city, wherever the king's decree arrived, the Jews rejoiced and had great celebration, declared a public festival and holiday, and many of the people of the land became Jews themselves, for they feared what the Jews might do to them. And so we have the story of Esther. The last chapter and a half is about the Festival of Purim and how they set that up as a future, you know, memorial for this event, the time God saved us when we were in Susa and in the Persian Empire. What can we say about this story? First of all, it's a story about anti-Semitism. It's very odd that, you know, Haman had a problem with Mordecai. Why not just get him? No, that's not good enough. We got to get all of his entire race. And we learn that anti-Semitism, a mysterious international constant that has existed from that time right up to the present day, hatred of Jews. It's inspired by the dragon, by Satan. Revelation 12 talks about how the dragon pursues the woman with child. Satan hates the Jews and he inspires others to hate them and to kill them. Why? Because God made a covenant with them, made them the chosen people. They're the people who he chose to carry out a great mission. Now, throughout the entire Old Testament, the writing of the Old Testament, the preserving of the practices of the types and symbols, and the bringing forth of Christ himself, a Jew, because the entire thing, it's the plan of God. It's what it is. And the Jews hold a central place in that. And for that reason, the evil one hates Jews. And Genesis 12:3, while making the covenant with Abraham, the first Jew, God said, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Well, we studied this in Hebrews, you know, how improbable did that sound out there in this semi-arid, you know, mountainside. One guy standing out there, and God says, through you, every family on earth is going to be blessed. This is going to be a worldwide thing. Turns out it is, yeah. And this covenant, of course, so the coming of Jesus, the plan, Jesus would have been coming out of nowhere without the Old Testament. It was the Old Testament, and the fact that it had been broadly and widely copied many thousands of times, spread out into many different countries, that these festivals and these temple and tabernacle practices, rituals had been carried on, which we saw in Hebrews, were all symbolic of the coming of Jesus Christ. When Jesus Christ came, he didn't just come as some dude showing up saying, guess what, I'm the Son of God. He came out of a carefully prepared milieu that had been set up by the Old Testament. And that's how people knew that he was real, is because of the prophetic word, the typical typological predictions, and everything else that went with it. This covenant, by the way, the Abrahamic covenant, is still in force today. It's never been revoked. And even though a lot of Jews aren't following Christ today, a lot of them are, more than any time in history. The Messianic Jewish movement, they call themselves, one of the reasons that more Jews are coming to Christ is because historically the church, the Christian church, was also very anti-Semitic and would make Jews who wanted to convert pronounce a curse on their own Jewish background. So they didn't get very many Jews converting to Jesus under those conditions. In the Messianic Jewish movement today, Messianic Jews call themselves completed Jews because they realize Jesus is not the negation of Judaism. He's the completion of the Judaism. He's exactly what this is, Judaism. We here, Christians, believe that we are Jewish. This is Judaism. Jewish by conversion, not by ethnically Jewish, but that, you know, that's the whole argument, is what is true Judaism. Anyway, don't curse Jews. Okay. Don't be anti-Semitic. Have nothing to do with that, because this is still in force. And people who hate the Jews are putting themselves on the fighting side of God. This story is also a story about God's sovereignty over history. There's all these times when it looks, you know, so grim, where it looks like, oh man, so many bad things could happen. And it's right up to our present day. You could look out in, and if you're a person like me that sometimes is afflicted with anxiety and worry, we wonder, it feels like, you know, trying to serve God, you know, but it seems like this ministry is like a house of cards. It seems like it could crumble at any moment. There's so many problems we're facing. And so we get this feeling that things are running out of control, you know. That's when maybe we need to read the book of Esther at that point and realize, yeah, that's probably exactly, that is how they felt. That's why they were mourning and wearing the sackcloth. It's like, we're doomed, we're ruined, this is going to be terrible. And yet God had everything under control. He had anticipated all of this. Already had his gal there where she needed to be. easily took care of Haman without the slightest difficulty. And there was not, you know, he had let the Babylonians conquer the Jews as a disciplinary measure, just as he promised he would in Deuteronomy. But he was not that they should be destroyed. That was never his will. And therefore, there was never any chance that any of this was going to succeed. It's also a story about this woman's courage and her stewardship and her faith. A story of a great woman of God. The courage, obviously, facing death. How terrifying it must be to walk into the presence of a despot like this when there's a law against that and people get killed for it all the time. Stewardship. Because Esther was a beautiful woman. To be a gorgeous woman is a position of power. Then as it is, still is today, you know, nothing's greater than to just be a spectacularly beautiful woman. They can basically call for whatever they want. But for Esther, her beauty and attractiveness wasn't to gratify herself, but was to be used in the service of God. That's an interesting thing to think about, whether you're a beautiful woman or a studly hunk or whatever. Is that beauty for your self-aggrandizement, for your self-gratification? Or is that something God's given you so that you can represent him in this world and use the hearing that you get from the fact that you are steaming hot to turn people away from that issue and onto the issue of God? That's what she did. And the fact that she was so hot, that turned out to be a pretty fortunate thing in this whole story. I mean, but she wasn't using it for herself. And of course, the faith that by laying herself on the line and walking in, that God would take care of her and accomplish his will through her, which he did. And so she becomes an awesome example to follow for all of us. And there you have the story of Esther. The last part of the book just talks about how they set up this celebration, the Festival of Purim. And to this day, it's a time they exchange gifts, and especially gifts to the poor. So that's kind of a cool aspect to it, too. All right. Yeah, God, we do so often run into these situations where we just are really very worried, very confused. And help us to see, God, you're not worried. You're not confused at all. And to rest in that, to learn how to just come under you as our sole, hiding place, our shelter against the world, God, and anything the evil one might have in mind for us. You're the one we can trust for complete protection as the all-powerful God and creator of heaven and earth. And we thank you at the same time that you're such a God of love and that you have known us by name. You call each of your sheep by name, and that we have that personal relationship with you. Thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.